Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
Hey there, welcome to the WUNC Politics Podcast for Friday, January 19th, 2018. I'm Jeff Tiberi from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. Glad to have you along for what we occasionally do during these political podcasts, which is bring you a longer conversation between Rob Schofield of NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the John Locke Foundation. This is part of a weekly radio segment that we run Fridays at 4:50 on WUNC.org, 91.5 FM, however it is that you listen to your favorite public radio station. So today on the podcast, we offer you the extended conversation between Becky and Rob about this week in North Carolina politics. Hope you enjoy. The seesawing saga of redistricting moved again this week. On Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay in a congressional gerrymandering case. That means that a lower federal court ruling issued last week is effectively halted. That decision had said North Carolina's U.S. House seats, remember there are 13 of them, are illegal partisan gerrymanders, and state legislators were ordered to redraw them. That will not happen now, and candidates begin filing for candidacy in less than a month. Political maps established in 2016 will be used. Rob, the high court effectively put a check on the federal appellate court here. Isn't that exactly how the judiciary is supposed to work?
Well, it is. That's how the judiciary is supposed to work if the appellate courts understand what they're doing. In this case, I think the Supreme Court got it wrong. What they have effectively almost guaranteed is that we're now going to proceed with illegal maps for yet another election to Congress. And I think the smoking gun in the lower court's ruling was Representative David Lewis's statement that the Republicans had drawn the congressional map to elect 10 out of 13 of the members of Congress from North Carolina to elect Republicans in 10 of 13 districts. And if he could have, he would have drawn it to elect 11 Republicans out of 13. So it was clearly, admittedly, a partisan gerrymander. This is a cutting-edge area of the law as to whether partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has some other cases before it. I mean, the hope is that long run, it's not going to matter. These kinds of maps are not going to survive going forward. But for now, it guarantees that, or it comes close to guaranteeing, that North Carolina will once again go to the polls and have to vote in these ridiculously gerrymandered and, I think, quite arguably unconstitutional districts.
I think the Supreme Court got it right. I think what we need is more definitive answers from the Supreme Court. Now, keep in mind that one of the reasons why they granted this stay was, in addition to the North Carolina case, there are cases in other states as well. Some of them are accusing Democrats of using partisan gerrymandering. Some of them are accusing Republicans of partisan gerrymandering. So there's equal offenders here, if you will. But, you know, this is one reason. Jeff, you mentioned in the introduction the seesaw of redistricting. And one of the reasons why we go back and forth and back and forth is because the rules that we've gotten on how to do this are so unclear. And not only North Carolina, but I think across the country, we're looking and depending on the Supreme Court to give us the guidelines and the definitive rules on how we do this. This question in these congressional races is, you know, how can you use partisan data to draw the districts? And if you can, how much? How much is too much? And we don't know because the Supreme Court won't tell us. So that's what this is all about. It does look like the Supreme Court will look at these cases, hopefully come up with some clear line definitions of these things. But it looks like it's going to be a while. And I agree with Rob that it looks like these maps that are in place now will see us through the 2018 election cycle, because it's just going to be too late when the Supreme Court does make a decision to be able to draw new maps and get candidates filed and hold an election. So again, you know, the seesaw of redistricting goes on and on.
And I do think technology is an important thing to note here, because while there have been challenges to redistricting efforts in the early 90s, the early 2000s, probably the early 80s, I'm not as familiar with those. What happened in 2010 on the political side was this wave of Republicans taking control in state governments, in executive mansions across the country. And also, for the first time, there was this more sophisticated computer software that allowed districts to be drawn much more specifically, with really much more precision. And I don't say that word tongue-in-cheek, but much more precision. So I think, you know, it's possible that if Democrats had this wave in 2010, it would be, you know, kind of a turning of the table, so to speak. But some of what we're dealing with right now, at least from my perspective, is because the technology has changed so much in recent years, and that's not going away. So it strikes me as just this maybe a seminal moment, an incredibly important moment, I think, for democracy and for how we elect people moving forward. And as you both mentioned, there's the Wisconsin case. There's also a case out of Maryland. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court heard a case this week. So overall, it really does seem like a fascinating issue. And we don't, I mean, I don't have any read on this. So I guess a brief follow-up for each of you. Do you have a sense of what we are going to get from Justice Kennedy and the high court on this?
Yeah, I think it's essential that the court rule against this kind of partisan gerrymandering. As you say, that the circumstances of our world have changed. And if we're going to go forward, I mean, it's only going to get worse if they don't enunciate some standards to prevent this kind of absurd rigging of elections. It's going to get worse. It's essential that the court take that action. I don't know what they're going to do. I know that we'd be in better shape if Merrick Garland had been confirmed to the Supreme Court like he should have. I think Neil Gorsuch is a man with a partisan agenda, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he goes the wrong way on this. But, you know, I remain hopeful.
And, Jeff, I would not predict what the Supreme Court is going to do either. They're really smart lawyers who understand this, who are arguing these cases to be persuasive one way or the other. But on your point of technology, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, that doesn't mean that technology is a bad thing or that it is a bad thing to be able to get a real assessment of where voters live, where voters are, those kind of things. The technology can be used to create fair, impartial districts so that we as voters have a choice and we get to elect our members of Congress, members of the General Assembly, instead of the other way around. And I think that's what we ought to be going for. I think these districts should be competitive. I think that we as voters ought to have choices and that elections ought to matter. And that's what I'm hoping no matter what the Supreme Court actually comes out with, what I'm hopeful is that there will be some black and white rules so that we understand how to get to those fair and impartial districts.
Meanwhile, in Washington, Tom Farr, a nominee for the federal bench, got another Senate committee hearing this week. The vacancy in the Eastern District is the longest in the country, open now for 13 years. Farr was up for the lifetime post last year, but didn't get a vote in the Senate, and his nomination expired, so this is kind of take two. He's been criticized for his work defending voting and labor laws enacted by the Republican-led General Assembly, and also for his work on a 1990 Jesse Helms campaign. Becky, full disclosure, you and Farr are friends. He got through the committee yesterday narrowly, an 11-10 party line vote, but I'm wondering, with such a slim majority for Republicans in the U.S. Senate, and this being an election year, how confident are you that Farr is going to get through this process and eventually go to the bench?
I'm very confident that he's going to get through this process. You know, again, Jeff, full disclosure, Tom Farr has been a friend of mine for probably 20 years. I can tell you from personal experience, he's a fine man. His colleagues in the American Bar Association, his colleagues across the legal profession have nothing but accolades for him. He has done his job over years, defended laws, defended people, like lawyers are supposed to do. I think that the Senate will see this, and I think that they will confirm him, and that, again, North Carolina will get a fine jurist and get one that has been empty for 13 years. I think we're way beyond the time that we need to fill this post, and I think Tom Farr is an excellent choice.
Well, with respect, I think there's credible evidence that Farr affirmatively misled or at least failed to disclose facts to the Senate Judiciary Committee about his participation in voter suppression activities when he was working for the Helms campaign. I think national civil rights groups are justifiably up in arms about this and will continue to be lodging very loud protests about Farr and the idea of him going on the federal bench. But the real story here is the outrageous behavior of Tom Tillis and Richard Burr in particular in blocking for the full length of the Obama presidency, the nomination of two very well-respected public servants, two women, Jennifer May Parker and Patricia Timmons Goodson, who happen to be African-American in a part of the state that has the largest African-American population, and has never in the 220 years of the United States, or however many years we've had federal courts, had an African-American judge. And Burr and Tillis blocked that those nominees. And now the Republicans have actually changed the rules. They've done away with the right of home state senators to block nominees. So Democrats in other states now are not permitted to block nominees like Republicans were under Obama. And so it's just, I think it just bespeaks this whole sort of winner take all, whatever it takes battle to win control of the courts that conservative Republicans are waging. They're doing it here in North Carolina. Same thing going on at the national level. And I think it's a big and disturbing story.
And Jeff, I'll just say, I think that we are ill-served to give in to this partisan bickering of, you know, you didn't vote for my guy, so I'm not going to vote for your guy. I've known Tom Farr for years. I've never known him to be bigoted, to do anything except be an excellent jurist and a fair jurist. That's what we need in North Carolina, are these kind of judges. And it's time to just move past the partisan bickering and get a really high qualified, good jurist in a position that, again, has been empty for 13 years.
We should note that Farr has never been a jurist. He's not been a judge. He's only been an advocate. He's been a lawyer for conservative causes, but he's never actually been a judge.
And gotten all kinds of awards and is widely respected in his profession.
I guess I would also note a couple of things. One, just for context, President Trump has nominated several people to the federal bench who have not only never served as judges, they've never served in a courtroom before. They've never even tried cases, which was something that I think went viral on social media within the last couple months. I mean, and that's really messy. But just to kind of, I guess, lay out the spectrum here, Tom Farr has a lot of courtroom experience, but no, he has not served on a bench before. Rob, I want to ask you one more thing. I just also want to note, we're in a web extra here. The Eastern District is a 44-county area. Population is about 1/4 African-American. That district has never had a black judge before. And that's been part of the rhetoric. That's been part of the criticism from the left, just about the politicizing of this seat over the last 13 years or so. But I'm wondering, I want to take the question I asked Becky and flip it to you. Conversely, can the pressure and criticism that has, it feels like it's mounting to some extent here, could this force Republicans' hand on this, in this opinion? Do you think there's any way that Farr doesn't get a full vote from the Senate?
I think there's a chance. I do think there's a chance. I mean, I think there's a reason, for instance, that his nomination did not pass muster last year and that it was allowed to expire, along with a lot of other controversial nominees. The politics of the United States Senate are very thick and very complex, and there's a lot of horse trading that's going to be going on in the weeks and months ahead, and there are going to be times when Mitch McConnell needs Democratic votes for particular issues, believe it or not, in the very closely divided Senate. So it's entirely conceivable to me that if national advocates make this a big enough issue, and I believe a lot of the civil rights organizations have now taken this up as a top cause in 2018, it's quite conceivable to me that it could be delayed further, or maybe even that the nomination could fail. It's still an uphill battle for progressives and for those who would oppose it, but I think there's a chance, actually.
Finally, Amazon. The finalists for an HQ2 site were announced this week. Raleigh-Durham is on the list. On one hand, this is a huge economic development project, 50,000 jobs, billions of dollars. And on another, this likely sets off an incentives bidding war with Jeff Bezos, presumably, as the likely top beneficiary. How do each of you view the inclusion of Raleigh-Durham as one of the final 20 possible sites for Amazon?
Well, I think it's a kudos to Raleigh-Durham for being on the list. It bespeaks the fact that the city is growing fast and well-respected and has a great workforce. And I mean, that's encouraging. I think Becky and I probably have some agreement on being skeptical about incentives, although I wouldn't go as far as some critics of the incentives packages have gone. One of the most encouraging things to me, actually, that happened recently in this incentives game was the Alabama car decision, in which we found out that Alabama has a higher corporate income tax and actually didn't offer as much in the way of incentives to Toyota, Mazda. And the reason they picked them was because it was just a better place in terms of workforce and supply chain. So ultimately, I'm hopeful that whatever decision Amazon makes is based not on incentives, and I think it won't be. I think incentives will be icing. I think that Governor Cooper and General Assembly should probably do well to keep that in mind. But, you know, I guess we all like the fact that our home city, home state is on the list.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Raleigh's a great place to live. It's where I've chosen to live, and I think it's a good choice. Certainly, we should be included in the top 20 and you know, possibly get the final award of this very plum kind of position. But let me just put this in perspective. When we talk about incentives, I think there can be a lesson from the Toyota plant. In the Toyota plant bidding war, North Carolina offered $1.5 billion in incentives to try to lure the Toyota plant. Alabama offered $375 million. So I think if there's a lesson there, it's that, you know, maybe incentives aren't the key to this. And as Rob mentioned, there was a well-skilled workforce. There was some supply infrastructure in place. North Carolina needs to focus on the things that we do really well. And I would argue to anybody, we're a model across the country in doing things well. We have low taxes. We have fewer regulations. We have low energy costs. I mean, the natural resources, the beaches, the mountains, the people that live in North Carolina, I think Rob and I would agree with that. You can't get any better than that. Those are the things that we need to focus on. I think this Amazon deal is incentives on steroids, and I think we really need to step back and evaluate what we're using our taxpayer money for. Just imagine, if you would, if we took that $1.5 billion that was offered to the Toyota plant and put that into infrastructure, put it into teacher pay, put it into the classrooms, put it into the community colleges. I mean, there's lots of ways that you can do it that I think benefit everyone. You put those kind of things in place with low taxes, fewer regulations, better investments in education, low energy prices, strong infrastructure, and then you step back and say North Carolina's open for business.
I will say that I think there is some concern, however, about the fact that actually because our investments in infrastructure and education have been declining in recent years, increasingly becoming threadbare, that the idea of adding thousands, 50,000 more people or more to the Triangle area over a relatively short period of time raises real questions about quality of life. And indeed the ability of such an area to even absorb that kind of growth and to do it in a smart way without expanding sprawl and pollution and all the things that we face here already, and especially in light of our failure so far to adequately invest in things like mass transit, it raises some real concerns about whether we could even really absorb that kind of rapid growth.
Don't forget, though, of those 50,000 people that would be taking these jobs, that's 50,000 additional taxpayers, you know, which is something else to think about. But Rob's right. I mean, when you have that sort of job, or I'm sorry, that population growth, and North Carolina is seeing that anyway, we're now the 10th largest state in the country, or I think it's 9th largest now. I mean, people are choosing to move to North Carolina, not because we're bribing them, because we're a great place to live. So anytime that you have that population growth, there are challenges involved with it. But I think that this speaks to the things that we're doing right. The fact that Raleigh is in the top 20. The Brookings Institute came out with a report this morning, Rob mentioned earlier, where we're actually in the top 5 in many of these criteria that are being looked at. I think we're doing things right here in North Carolina, in Raleigh. I think we need to focus on that and not so much on these cash giveaways, these incentives. It's just foolish.
All right, a curveball, a lighter one. Perhaps a fun one to get you out of here on. It's been a very snowy week. The Triangle largely shuts down. And I'm wondering from each of you, what was the best thing you did in the last couple of days, thanks to or inspired by the winter weather?
Well, Wednesday was my birthday, so I got to have a day off. I got a snow day on my birthday. I got to work from home.
We all celebrated.
Yeah, I bet you all did. But so that was good. Got to spend some time with my wife and do some work from home. That was fun.
Really boring. I cleaned out my pantry and my kitchen cabinets, which is something that I've needed to do for 6 months. So good excuse to stay home and get some things like that done. And also listen to NPR.
Becky Gray is a senior vice president with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is a director of NC Policy Watch. And they joined us from our studios in downtown Raleigh at the Natural Sciences Museum on what was a wintry week here in the Triangle. If you enjoyed the podcast, feel free to give it a ranking, a rating, a review, stammer through something as I just did. Leave a question or comment for us as well. And if there's somebody that you'd like to hear on the podcast and you haven't, feel free to drop a suggestion somewhere, Twitter, Facebook, wherever it is that email, perhaps some people still use that as well. So thanks for listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and throughout the week, Stay up to date on everything that's happening, judicial nominations, congressional redistricting challenges, and of course the weather at our website, wunc.org. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Have a great weekend.